This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. It's been more than 10 years since the Human Genome Project was completed, a major feat for the species as a whole. The biological achievement has had many consequences for how we understand the human body and our inherited diseases, but it's also opened up questions about delving into our ancestry, one community for whom personal genealogical information has been extremely important are African Americans. Using DNA technology, companies have been able to help African Americans trace their ancestry back to pre-slavery eras on the African continent. This exercise has multiple emotional and social impacts, and exploring this is my guest, Alondra Nelson. She is the Dean of Social Science and a Professor of Sociology and Gender Studies at Columbia University. Her earlier book was Body and Soul, The Black Panther Party and the Fight Against Medical Discrimination. And her new book that we'll be discussing now is called The Social Life of DNA, Race, Reparations, and the Reconciliation After the Genome. Welcome to the show, Alondra.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Now, you start your book with reminiscing about the Alex Haley series Roots, which was a historic moment in television. I remember watching it as a child. I remember being very moved by it. But it was also a seminal moment in the American consciousness about the roots of African American people. Was that the start of your fascination with ancestry?
Absolutely. I think for those of us who are able to, were old enough to sort of experience that Roots moment, it was really powerful, in part because it was a time when we all watched television synchronously. So you didn't have DVRs, I think we didn't even have VHS, and we all watched television together as local communities and as a national community. And so it was also a time, you know, 1976 was the nation's bicentennial. So you'll probably recall that there were lots of talks about the history of the nation and the founding of the nation. And so to have this really powerful narrative that was one of the very first miniseries genre. So it ran over 8 days in 1977 and to have people riveted watching this at home together, often as families, at a poignant moment of celebration of American history, I think really gave us pause and forced us to really think about the full breadth and depth and then the tragedy of American history and the founding of this nation, and to really think about what the personal stories of slavery might be beyond thinking of racial slavery in a kind of abstract form. So Haley in that moment really makes it a family story. I mean, the subtitle of the book is The Saga of an American Family. And so it really brings it into people's living rooms in a very profound way.
Right, and the history, one's personal history, is an important thing. It makes you feel grounded about yourself. But for African Americans, you know, most African Americans can only go back a few generations, and then there's this erasure. There's a blank space, and then we just have a generalized history, a very painful generalized history of loss, of wrenching, being wrenched away from the point of origin of your ancestors. So is it a particularly important thing for the African American community, for Blacks in general, to be able to use this technology we have today to find out what your family's origins are?
Yes, I think, you know, one of the reasons I spent a decade studying African Americans' interactions with genetic ancestry testing is because, you know, our community, my community, is the community that could potentially be most impacted by the information. As you suggest, the identity Black or African American, or let's say African American, for example, is a continental identity. It refers to the entire continent of Africa, which is scores of countries, scores of language groups, hundreds of ethnic groups. And, you know, and so there's a lack of specificity that's available to African Americans. And there is some, you know, there are arguable things that people might say about the technology and whether or not we should be using it, and whether or not it gives us really the truth of identity or the truth of ethnicity. But for a community that doesn't have an ability to access in any other way, so you can't often use traditional genealogical archive records. You can't use vital records often. You might have sort of census records or records from slavery plantations that may not have surnames, or people's names may have changed since then. So it's very, really, it's difficult history to find, and genetic ancestry testing offers a way, even if it's often, a kind of probability or scientific inference, to be able to access, for many people for the very first time, a connection with an identity and a community before the slave trade.
So tell us about Rick Kittles. He and his company, African Ancestry. He figures in your book quite prominently. Who is Rick Kittles, and what service does he offer, if you will?
Yeah, so Rick Kittles, I realize, is very important to the story sort of early on. So he is a 40-something African-American geneticist, one of a handful of Black geneticists. And he starts, while he's in graduate school at George Washington University, completing his PhD, he is also a junior researcher on the African Burial Ground Project, which is a large cemetery. It was formerly called the Negroes Burying Ground in Lower Manhattan. And it was a very historic and political site beginning in the 1990s when it was uncovered here in New York City. And Rick Kittles, as a scientist working on this project, brings molecular genetic tools to the research project, and and what he helps the project to do is to surmise what might have been what the researchers called the macro-ethnic affiliations of these people. So could we use forms of scientific analysis and forms of science, social science analysis, to make some sort of guesses about who these people might have been, where they might have been from before they were brought to the Americas in the Middle Passage. And so Rick Kittles uses the innovation of relatively new DNA techniques, and he creates a reference database of contemporary African DNA. And he's able to extract DNA samples from less than a dozen of the hundreds of burials that are excavated, and to amplify these and sequence these, and he compares them to the database. And he's able to make some very broad stroke inferences about people, where people were from. So Bantu-speaking region as opposed to the Gold Coast region, et cetera. And so he takes this research project and it becomes a commercial venture. And in part, he changes it into a commercial venture because as news gets out among activist communities and the Black community in New York City that he's doing this kind of research, African Americans all over the country and from all over the world are contacting him, they're writing him, they're emailing him to try to figure out if they could use these services. And so Rick he co-founds this company with an African American woman named Gina Page in 2003. It's one of the company's African Ancestry. It's one of the first four genetic ancestry testing companies to emerge in the United States. And it is of these four beginning companies, it's one of the only two that's remaining. So now it's been in business for 13 years. And Rick becomes very important, not only because he has the technical skills, but also because he has the cultural skills. He's a very important cultural broker for allowing African Americans who, for legitimate historical reasons and because of a legacy of medical oppression and medical apartheid, are often distrustful of scientific research, clinical medical research, and the like, he was a trustworthy figure. And many of the people I spoke to, when I would say, how can it be, given this history, that it seems so easy for you to put a DNA sample in a FedEx envelope and send it out into the world? They would say, well, I trust Rick Kittles. And so Rick Kittles is very good at building trust with his client base, and he talks to them both as someone who's been interested in African-American history and genealogy his whole life, and also someone who is interested in the way that history can be important for Black freedom and liberation struggles. So when he was a graduate student, in addition to doing this really cutting-edge research on the African Burial Ground Project, he was also engaged in protests at the Smithsonian Institute, around the Africa Hall. So there was at the Natural History Museum, there was a display of artifacts from Africa, and he and a group of activists thought that they were very simplistic and pathologizing images, and they succeeded in having a demonstration that shut the hall down. So he's a very complicated kind of Renaissance man and brings all of this scientific and cultural power to the project of African ancestry, his
now,
company.
Alondra, there are several figures in your book, and the fascination with genealogy runs quite deep. And one other figure that you bring up is the actor Isaiah Washington, who this is sort of a pet project of his. And he has also been a proponent of people looking into their own background. What role does he play, and how popular has it become, I should ask, among various communities, African-American communities in the U.S. to do this exercise, to go through this exercise of sending in, you know, a swab to find out where your ancestors hailed from?
One of the more surprising things to me over the course of doing this research and spending time with genealogy communities and family historians is how popular it has become and how widespread. So, you know, many of us in our families have the person that's called the kin keeper, who is the person who keeps track of the family records. It's the one person in the family, if you want to figure out or catch up with what's going on with all of your aunts and uncles, with all of your cousins, you call this person and they can catch you up with everybody. And this person is also often the family genealogist or the family record keeper. And typically these kin keepers, these genealogists were older women in the family, matriarchs in a family. And so those initially were the people that I was talking to when I was trying to understand the impact of the emergence of genetic ancestry testing. But certainly by the end of the time I was doing my research, you had people across the whole age spectrum, class spectrum, different ethnicities and racial groups being engaged in genetic genealogy. So it's really, the market for it has really expanded. And accurate figures are a little bit hard to get because these are still mostly privately owned companies, except for 23andMe, which is part of the Google enterprise, which is a publicly traded company. But we know that it's estimated to be a business that drives more than $1 million and sales every year. And we know that more than 1 million people have used the services to date.
So I want to play a video for you and our audience of Jasmine Kanick. She's here in Southern California. She's a journalist. And she went through this exercise. She's a friend of Isaiah Washington's. She went through this exercise of finding her own ancestry and then she videotaped herself and posted it to YouTube.
It is with great pleasure that I report our Matri clan analysis successfully identified your maternal genetic ancestry. The DNA sequence that we determined from your sample shares ancestry with people living in two countries today, the Bubi people in Bioko Island, Equatorial Guinea, and the Tikar, Hassa, and Fulani peoples in Cameroon.
That is a video of Jasmine Kanick exploring her own ancestry, and actually when she found out the people that she hailed from, Equatorial Guinea and Cameroon. She videotaped that. She posted a video on YouTube. Alondra, what is the sort of psychological impact for people discovering where they're from? I mean, I can't imagine that today it might make a huge difference for one, you know, person to necessarily think, oh, my ancestors were from Ethiopia or Cameroon or Nigeria. I mean, you find out where your ancestors were from, and that's just the fact of it. But is there this sort of emotional impact that just the knowledge provides, and then also a social and political impact, because the subtitle of your book has the word reparations in it?
Yes. So yes, there is an impact, and you see it with Jasmine Kanick talks about the ancestry certificate that she gets. She calls it a birth certificate. Isaiah Washington, who's her friend, who encourages her to do genetic ancestry testing, also calls his certificate of ancestry a birth certificate. So for many people, it's really emotionally an emotional experience, because it's, for some people, a remaking of themselves or a rebirthing of themselves. And Isaiah Washington, who received his genetic ancestry testing results in 2004, by 2010 has dual citizenship. So he's carrying by 2010 a Sierra Leonean passport. So it's not only his birth certificate, but it becomes a vehicle for him getting a new passport as well.
Wow, so that's incredible.
Yeah, it's really something. And so it is really emotional for people in that way. But, you know, it also, you know, I think it would be, we'd be underappreciating the power of this of genetic ancestry testing if we thought that it ended at the moment where someone was told that they have, there's evidence that they have ancestry in Cameroon or the Gambia or Equatorial Guinea. Because then what it does in the world, part of its power is that it allows people to make new relationships, to travel, to open up their idea of what their community is and where they belong in the world. So the experiences that people have are emotional ones. They're not dissimilar often from the ones that you see on genetic genealogy reality television shows. But then other things happen, right? So that people will, it'll become a reason for people to make relationships in their community. So one gentleman I spoke to realizes he's associated with an ethnic group in Angola, and he realizes that he's been taking classes all semester with a woman, an immigrant to the United States from Angola, and this becomes the test results, an occasion for them to spark up a friendship. Other people travel to the places to which they've been associated and spend time there. In the case of Isaiah Washington, he built a school in Sierra Leone and has been doing lots of philanthropy in that country. And so there are lots of relationships that can happen. And then they spin out as well into things like reparations politics. So how
has that ended up? Because the issue of reparations is a very important issue. It's also been a contentious issue for obvious reasons. The U.S. legal system and justice system, they have various statutes of limitations on various issues. But honestly, obviously, slavery should be a huge, ginormous exception to statutes of limitations. But there's been a huge fight against that. The reparations have even come up during the elections as an issue. You know, there's folks like Ta-Nehisi Coates have made it an issue that people are still talking about. How could people potentially use their genealogical background to bring up reparations? Has it been done, and has it been successful?
So the court had always been a very complicated site for reparations activists. So this is a struggle that goes back hundreds and hundreds of years. And the court had been complicated because there's this doctrine of sovereign immunity, which says that the executive branch cannot sue itself. And effectively, earlier attempts to use the courts to accomplish slavery reparations was basically the executive suing itself. And so Deidre Farmer Palman, who becomes a lead plaintiff in a class action suit for reparations for slavery in 2002, decides to take a kind of genealogical approach, in part because she's a genealogist and she understands that this could be potentially used as a way to get around the sovereign doctrine, sovereign immunity hurdle, and also to get around the statute of limitations. And so then, and also the strategy is not to sue the state, but to sue the multinational corporations that still exist today, in part because they were allowed to benefit from the wealth that was made from the expropriated labor of enslaved Africans. And so she comes up with this strategy, and she says, her and seven other plaintiffs, and they bring the suit, Farmer Palman versus Fleet Boston, against 21 multinational corporations. And they say, we're the descendants of slaves, and our ancestors were, the wealth was made for these companies on the backs of our ancestors. And so within a year and a half, the court dismisses the case without prejudice. And one of the court's findings, the initial court's findings, was that the plaintiffs didn't have standing. So the standing doctrine says you have to be able to demonstrate in a way that's efficacious to the court that you are the injured party or related to the injured party, and with a kind of specificity that the court requires. And in this decision, the court says, you can't just merely allege, quote unquote, merely allege that you are related to the descendants of slaves. You have to be able to prove it, more than your assertion of it. And so the plaintiffs regroup with their attorneys, and they decide that they're going to really push this genealogical piece as leverage in this case. And Farmer Palman and one of the other plaintiffs go to the offices of African Ancestry, the company in Washington, D.C., and they purchase genetic ancestry testing kits. And just to give you a sense of the temporality, so African Ancestry starts in 2003, and within a year of its existence, here you have reparations activists already sort of thinking moves down the chessboard such that, this is a new technology. Very few people have used it at this point, but here you have these activists that are seizing upon it to make claims in the court. And so they get the test results, and they enter their test results as evidence in this civil court case that they are the descendants of slaves. And the evidence is, One person through matrilineal testing was inferred to be associated with the Gambia, another with Niger, and other places on the African continent. And so this is an endeavor to really force the court to deal with the fact that these are African-descended people, and to the extent that people who are the descendants of slaves can show that they are the descendants of slaves, this is the best that you can do at this time. You know, this is the sort of best new cutting-edge innovative evidence that you can show. And so they entered it into the court as evidence in a smaller case. And the court, again, rejects it in part because it says it draws a fine line between genetic ties and genealogical ties. And so, you know, they sort of suggest, like, you know, while in broad strokes you are maybe related to people in the Gambia, we can't prove that, or this evidence doesn't prove that you are related to someone who was brought from the contemporary place that is the Gambia, and brought in the Middle Passage, and then they couldn't prove the sort of specific genealogy to one of the plaintiffs in the case. And so there was a kind of genealogical specificity and a kind of capitalist specificity that the court required that the plaintiffs weren't able to provide.
And so there are, of course, limitations then of this technology. Well, Alondra, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and best of luck to you with your book, and thank you for this fascinating conversation.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
My guest is Alondra Nelson. She's a Dean of Social Science and Professor of Sociology at Gender Studies at Columbia University. Her earlier book was Body and Soul, The Black Panther Party and the Fight Against Medical Discrimination. We've just been discussing her latest book, The Social Life of DNA, Race, Reparations, and Reconciliation After the Genome. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.